Oh, hi, Joe. This is Arnold from KOWS here in Sonoma County, California.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good. Glad to be talking to you.
Thank you very much for giving us some insight into the Population Media Center. Population, what a topic. It's about basically the most touchy subject there is in the world, I would say.
Certainly not without its share of controversy and, I guess the term is baggage these days. It's got some baggage associated with it. I would agree.
What is, who is the Population Media Center and, what is your mission?
Sure. Population Media Center is a nonprofit organization based in South Burlington, Vermont. We work all over the world. We're an entertainment organization driven by a desire to affect positive social impact around the world. So we create hit TV and radio shows, both domestically and abroad, that have a unique capacity for not only raising awareness of a lot of compelling social issues among a large number of people, especially around women's rights, reproductive health, girls' education, environment, and those sort of things, but also for actually motivating audiences to adopt new behaviors. So we estimate we've impacted about 500 million people in about 50 countries around the world since we were founded in 1998.
So really, basically departing from the stern father figure of you've got to do this to a something that people can relate to, in other words.
Yes, absolutely. So our work is predicated on a lot of formative research and going into the communities where we intend to work and really getting to know the beneficiary audiences. So we want to find out what people talk about in their daily lives, what's on the dinner table, what are some of the common struggles, what do people wear. We want to really understand the humanity of these people. And we also work with mostly local creatives, so local producers and writers. And the whole purpose there is to create characters and stories that the beneficiary audiences are going to really resonate with. This is called parasocial interaction, when you create a really great story and you sort of get emotionally involved with the characters. There's a theoretical term for that. And what we're then able to do is use the social learning theory of Albert Bandura, and we create positive and negative role models within the context of a story, and then these very important transitional characters, which are really designed to really, really resonate with the beneficiary audiences. And then we bring the characters through, a whole series of dramatic, cliffhanging, entertaining stories. And basically along the way, we present to audiences different options for behavior. We kind of role model that in the fictional world, and that allows audiences to reflect upon what maybe might be the best decision for them in their real lives. So this methodology was born way back in the early 70s, actually late 60s, in Brazil in the form of the telenovela. And we've adapted it to pursue our own mission, which is to try to stabilize rural population at a level that can be supported by the world's renewable resources. And that's what we do.
Yeah, that's a huge topic, to say the very least.
Yes,
but,
it is.
But so necessary. And for me, I went to one of the premier environmental film festivals last month, a few weeks ago, in Nevada City. And, they have hundreds of documentaries on all facets of the environment and, and various attached things, but not one was on population. It was stunning that really is driving all the other things. Is that how you see it?
Well, certainly, the scale of humanity is always going to be a factor in any calculation of what a sustainable living scenario with the environment may be.
Right.
Scale is crucial. I mean, it's just absolutely essential to consider the scale. I mean, the scope of our behaviors is also very important. And unfortunately, that's where this dichotomy often rears its head in public discourse and between well-intended activists on either side of this, what I consider a false dichotomy between humanity's behaviors and humanity's scales. Clearly, I think anyone who seriously thought about sustainable living with the planet realizes that it's both our scale of humanity and the scope of our behaviors that need intervention and, you know, a lot of changes.
Indeed. Well, I think the scariest thing when I went to your website really is the population count. I advise everyone to go there and see it ticking. That is scary.
Well, yeah, so the net growth, which is birds minus deaths, right now is about 1.5 million people every week. And that works out to something quite eye-popping, like 228,000 people per day. I think that's 9,000 people an hour or something like that. So that's net growth. And then if you stop to think about that, all those people are deserving humans who require a base level of resources to lead a prosperous life, you can start to imagine the enormous demands that we're placing on the living organism of the planet. To think that that is ongoing day after day after day after day, year after year, we're adding about a billion people to the planet every 12 to 13 years. Wow. You know, then you really start to worry about the health of the planet. And I think that we're starting to see, and arguably maybe have been for a while, but it seems to be that, you know, the ecosystems seem to be rapidly fraying at this point. And yeah, continuing to add that volume of people, you know, doesn't portend well for how things may turn out.
Been around a bit, and you know, when I was about 11 or 12 in the early 60s, there was 2 billion people. Now we're approaching 8 billion. I mean, you know, I became an engineer, mechanical engineer, and I looked at those, you know, I've looked over those numbers over the decades, and it's pretty awful, you know, what it portends.
Yeah, so the other thing about the population issue is it's very easy to get pessimistic because it is clearly the Earth is being impacted in terrible ways already. I mean, we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction of other species. We have obvious climate change and ocean acidification going on. You know, I think 70% of the Great Barrier Reef has officially died due to acidification and ocean warming. You know, we've got the starving whales in Puget Sound, species going extinct every day. So it's pretty incontrovertible that the biosphere is suffering. And then to think of this rapid population growth ongoing, it's very easy to get pessimistic, and many people argue cogently there's really not much reason for hope. There's almost no justification for hope if you look at the trends of population and how the ecosphere seems to be going into demise. But that said, I think that we can never let go of the power of positive thinking. You know, there are paths forward that will take a lot of work, blood, sweat, and tears, but even on the population issue, it's not an intractable problem. And I would caution people not to get into that sort of scared, pessimistic mindset, even on the population issue, because with proper investments in international family planning and empowerment of women, girls, education around the world, the population issue is actually fairly easy to intervene on, and you can see return on investment fairly quickly within a generation. In some instances, countries have really turned their population picture around. So we're not without the power of positive thinking and interventions like population media centers. We certainly feel it can contribute to you know, managing this huge challenge.
You know, in the Western world, we're not adding much population, and you know, in some places it's going down. So where are the main countries or areas where this is really impacting population?
Well, keep bearing in mind that, you know, we were just one world. The world population is growing up quickly, but your point's well taken that many of the high fertility countries, so to speak, are largely congregated in sub-Saharan Africa and some in South Asia. Here in those areas, we still have a large desired family sizes and an aversion to modern contraception, which comes about from a variety of different factors. Unfortunately, they're not positive ones. It's usually rumors and myths around the safety and efficacy of contraception, a lot of patriarchal social norms, some fatalism, religiosity, all sort of work to currently make modern contraception uptake in sub-Saharan Africa problematic. And then, again, the sort of traditional notion of large family size. So, for example, in Niger, the ideal number of children is around 8 or 9 right now. And about 50% of the women in Niger never intend to use contraception. In Senegal, the ideal number of children is about 5.5. 60% of women never intend to use contraception in Senegal. So we see this sort of across sub-Saharan Africa with ongoing desire for large families and an aversion to the uptake of modern contraception.
Right, but obviously that brings the point of, if they're still having so many kids, where is the food and the water and those other things coming in those very often very poor countries? How is that anywhere near sustainable? How is it even being done now? Is it the extractive industries are sort of underpinning it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it kind of goes back to how we opened it. It's just amazing that the planet has been sort of cajoled into providing so much resources for humanity in general already.
Yeah.
Of course, that's come at a humongous cost to other species and the biosphere. And really, what we have right now is a sort of a fossil fuel subsidy around global food production, where without intense use of fossil fuels, that we couldn't even come close to producing the amount of food that would be necessary to sustain a population of 7.6 billion. So, in terms of sub-Saharan Africa, the good news is that the populations started, so to speak. I mean, obviously there were people living in Southern Africa for a long time, but populations of these countries are, say, going back to the 60s, were quite low. So, you know, countries maybe only 10 million, 3 million. So even though they've been growing rapidly, their populations still haven't eclipsed the local carrying capacity of those countries. But certainly we're seeing huge impacts in terms of local deforestation, local biodiversity declines. And then also we have to bear in mind that it's a global food market. So in a lot of instances, you know, it's not as if these countries are totally dependent upon their domestic production for food. In fact, they're not.
So our monocultural, industrial-based agriculture here is really in reinforcing the population growth in those countries, in other words.
Well, yeah, and everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting how that's all tied in. Okay. I hadn't thought of that connection before.
Yep.
Now, yourself, Joe, what brought you to the organization? What's your background and your inspiration in this work?
Sure. Well, I've always been an environmentalist at heart. I grew up in a fairly rural part of central New York State. And, you know, I grew up outdoors, in the fields, in the creeks, in the forest. So I've always had an affinity for nature. And then I guess when I was coming of age, I looked in somewhat aghast and with horror at the urban mindset and the industrialization of so many beautiful places, and it just didn't make sense to me. And so I got a degree in environmental advocacy and organizing. Now, interestingly enough, the master's level degree, so I went through 6 years of secondary education. Uh-huh. And I believe in those 6 years of coursework, I had about 15 minutes of education on the population issue. So it wasn't, I hadn't even really ever thought about it. Of course, then when I graduated, I needed a job, and I literally answered a help wanted ad for a population activist organization in the New England region. And then over the course of my career with them, I met the founder and president of Population Media Center, and eventually went to work for him. So it was really quite by chance that I got into the population issue per se, though I've always had an environmental inclination.
Nice. That sounds a very organic way of getting into it.
Yeah.
Your work covers an amazing scope, but it seems obviously the real basis of it is the rights of women and girls. Could you go over that to explain why that's so important in this context?
Sure. It's a good question, and I think it gets to the heart of this intertangled set of issues that are driving our unsustainable relationship to the planet. It turns out that anywhere in the world that women have enjoyed equal education with men, have access to modern contraception, have access to the workforce so they can pursue their interests and make monetary gain from that, are at least somewhat quasi-equal with men in terms of political representation. Lo and behold, every time those sort of set of situations manifest, fertility rates drop to replacement level, which is defined as the number of children you would have with your partner to sustain the population at a certain level over the course of time. Generally, that's about 2 children per family. So the point being, when women are able to realize equal social status with men, enjoy all those benefits, women choose voluntarily to have 2 children. So when you look at some of these high fertility countries, the first thing you probably would want to assume is that women are not enjoying equal social status with men. They're not enjoying education. They're not enjoying unrestricted access to modern contraception. They're unable to get into the workforce and assert their earning power next to men. And then if you look at, that's exactly what the case is. Now, these oppressions that women are suffering are deeply rooted in knowledge, attitudes, behaviors, and social norms. So it's not as if you can go and contract to put up a bunch of billboards and tell everyone that, you know, women should be treated equal and with compassion, respect, and educated, so on and so forth, because no one's going to pay attention, because it's a much more deeply rooted dynamic that we're trying to drive after. Yeah, you can't underestimate the value of a sustainable future around women's education and empowerment. It's just absolutely vital. So that is why we really focus on that issue, because we know that it impacts our other issues that we care about, which is the environment and how population fits into a sustainable future.
You bring those novella-type information things to a country or an area. How do you make the differentiation between, like, indigenous, you know, how do you, I suppose, sort of like the Star Trek thing of not interfering with the indigenous population, you know, not impacting them, but yet impacting them? That must be very tricky.
Well, it goes back to sort of what I mentioned at the beginning, which is that we always work with local in-country management and creative talent. So that includes even like the formative research. So we'll work with an in-country vendor to do the formative research. We'll help local teams in terms of producers and writers and actors we sort of go through an educational process with them where we go over the formative research with this local talent, and then they actually create the storylines themselves. So they're interpreting with their own cultural acumen and sense of the research that we bring them and applying their real-life experience from the very communities and countries which they live. And that is how that we create our story arcs and behavior change stories. Is actually, we don't. it's the local creatives that do that. So that's why, and you're right, of course, because no one wants to go home after a hard day's work and listen to a lecture or, a PSA announcement. You know, people go home to be entertained. That's why getting that local sensibility and helping them to interpret the research is absolutely critical.
Right, and obviously the other side of the equation there is the men. When you come in, obviously, with that focus on women and girls, how do you bring the men along?
Well, it's a good question, of course. So there's all sorts of issues that Population Media Center can work on, and clearly some of them involve men, because, you know, men have a role in deciding who gets to go to school in the family. Is it just the boys, or are the girls going to be educated too? Domestic violence, early and forced marriages, these are all broad social issues that men have a huge stake in. Promoting basic child health, nutrition, and protection. Are the boys going to eat as well as the girls, and vice versa? And then, of course, just the general sense of sexual and reproductive health and rights, and making sure that women have that agency. These are all involve men. I mean, there's two sides to every coin, the men and the women. So it's really on an issue-dependent basis and a story-dependent basis about how we actually enact our theory of change, but it's well within our capacity to have both men and women as the transitional beneficiary audiences.
Right, because you don't want to set up a, you know, them and us thing, isn't it, in the process?
No, definitely not.
Yeah. And I suppose that's it, the exposure of men just watching these situations, they learn at the same time as well.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, it's not just for the women, say.
No. Most of our shows are very popular among a wide range of ages and genders. So, yeah, we don't have any problem with creating the hit entertainment. And then, you know, hopefully we design our characters and our storylines sufficiently to make an impact.
Well, yeah. I mean, even, you know, using local people, I mean, obviously, you're still on, you know, very touchy grounds, you know, with religion and local cultural norms. So how do the local people overcome those type of lines in the sand?
Well, I mean, I guess the power of an entertaining story is profound. And if you can draw people into the drama of the story and get them excited about the cliffhangers. Mm. And there's a great deal of sophistication in every human culture. So if you're introducing a controversial character into a story, maybe a fundamentalist religious cleric or something, and you put them into the story, for example, people are going to consume that entertainment content. But then, you know, what they're going to do is they're going to go to the kitchen and talk about it with their spouse, or else they're going to talk about it at the water cooler the next day. So what you're actually doing is more than reaching people on an individual basis who consume that entertainment, you're fomenting conversations within the community. And I'm sure there's some fancy theory that you would call that, but basically what it is this diffusion of innovation among a populace. So you introduce the idea with your entertainment, you introduce the character, and you get people to talk about them. What did you think about that character lesson? What did you think about what he said? Do you agree? And these things just organically happen. And so that's where a lot of the power of our methodology actually comes from, is fomenting these community conversations and letting them we certainly aren't in any position to control that. That's just an organic conversation. Right. And then sensibilities will evolve on their own.
It must be fascinating, obviously, to see reactions and that places where you've worked, where the families have got smaller, and you know, things like that. What is the, obviously, culturally, they had large families for various reasons, but with smaller families, is that bringing up different issues?
What do you mean?
Well, I suppose, you know, because they've gone for centuries with large families, suddenly with a contraction in that. I'm just wondering how that's being adjusted to in their cultures.
Well, I mean, the pace of change, I think, is, you know, the population issue is unique because there's a certain amount of momentum to that. So just to zoom out to a global level again before I answer your question, there's this thing called population momentum. So that is when your population, the base of your population pyramid, so younger cohorts of people, 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 15, 10 to 15, 15 to 20, if the base of that pyramid is much larger than your middle-aged people and your elderly people, even if you have a replacement-level fertility, population is going to continue to grow fairly rapidly for a while just because of the sheer number of people that are moving into their reproductive careers. That's the big picture. Sometimes even dramatic reductions in fertility don't show up as the cessation of population growth for decades. So then more specifically, in the communities where we work, which is really all around the world, but in terms of smaller family size decisions, I mean, usually the immediate outcome in terms of the nuclear family is that their economic well-being increases, their health increases, and their prosperity increases. You know, plenty of studies have shown that smaller family size are healthier families, they're more prosperous. So it's a good effect at the individual household level. And then, of course, society adjusts in the aggregate.
Yeah, I suppose because it is a literally one person at a time, isn't it, this type of thing. And, yeah, how do you evaluate those effects and changes?
Well, our monitoring evaluation, of course, is focused on our programmatic work, our entertaining dramas, and other entertainment content. So we do a variety of monitoring evaluation. Sometimes we choose to monitor patronization of reproductive health clinics, and we'll ask people who are coming in to the clinic for the first time what was their motivation for coming in, and they'll have a queue of answers they can choose from. One might be radio, and if we have a radio show in that area, we'll ask, well, what specific program motivated you to come in from the radio, and then they'll have a queue, and they will choose our program at some certain rate, and we'll mark that down. We also have representative online surveys after the program is complete. So we can do comparisons between listeners and non-listeners to our content and find out, for example, that listeners were 1.5 times more likely than non-listeners to say their family size was between 0 and 3 children as opposed to 4 and more. That was a result we got in Rwanda earlier this decade.
You mentioned the methodology and the theories behind what you're going at. I read here Miguel Sabido pioneered the foundations of what you're doing. Could you explain that a little bit?
Our programs are complex behavioral interventions. It's a highly evolved communications technique, and it is constructed from multiple scientifically validated communication, psychosocial, and psychological theories. What Sabido did actually was quite interesting because he sort of alighted on the power of the telenovela by happenstance. I think one of the novellas had a heroine who was destitute in the city and didn't know how to make ends meet, she took up a sewing business with her Singer sewing machine. And all of a sudden, Singer sewing machines in the areas where this telenovela was being broadcast, sales skyrocketed, and Sabido took note of this. And he started to wonder, why was there such a power of this suggestion in these telenovelas? And what eventually happened was he was introduced to Albert Bandura, who was the fourth most cited psychologist in the history of psychology. And they got together, and they, of course, were very interested in each other. But Bandura's social learning and social cognitive theories teach us that human behavior, or excuse me, humans generally learn vicariously. We look to other people to sort of mitigate our risks as we learn, because learning by doing is actually fairly inefficient. If you can watch someone else practice a behavior or try to do something and see if they succeed or fail, it's much easier than just to copy that behavior because you already know the outcome. So there's a whole host of theories that we weave into our intervention. They are social learning, social cognitive theory from Bandura, parasocial interaction, which I mentioned before, which is this propensity of human beings to emotionally bond with fictional characters in entertainment content, whether it's on TV or radio. There's a whole other host of theories, behavioral theories, that we sort of weave together to come out with our intervention. But I think for the purposes of this discussion, I mean, the role modeling is the most important part of our work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I suppose now we have YouTube, of course, to show us how to do everything.
Right.
Environmental protection. I mean, obviously, amongst all this, we want, in terms of edging the world's population down, those novellas, somehow you've got to weave that in as well, that discussion, so that it can work on a grassroots level.
Well, yeah, certainly we, some of our programs have role modeled planting tree seedlings and reforestation. Some of our programs have role modeled the benefits of protecting gorilla habitat, and realizing the benefit of gorillas in terms of local economies and the benefits of tourism. Because of the flexibility our methodology offers, we can really talk about just about anything in terms of targeting behavior change. So one of our big aspirations actually is to work more in the United States around carbon emissions and sustainable choices in terms of not using so much plastic, et cetera, et cetera. There's really, the sky's sort of the limit for us in terms of the issues we can address. Of course, it's all dependent on, you know, what sort of funding comes our way and what the markets can generate for us in terms of return on our charitable investment.
How are you funded? Where does that come from?
We have a combination of public and private money. So we currently have a program in Zambia right now that's funded by USAID, for example. And then we had a program in the United States, actually, on Hulu. It just ended a couple years ago. It had a nice 5-year run on Hulu. East Los High, and that was funded primarily by an individual donor in the United States. So we have a fairly diversified funding stream. We're at populationmedia.org if anyone's interested in learning more about PMC or supporting our work. Well, you know, that's one of the things that I think people are... It appears, I don't want to be too optimistic, but it appears the popular consciousness is finally beginning to grasp that this isn't something on the horizon, but actually we're right in the midst of a crisis. We're in an environmental crisis. One could call it a catastrophe from the perspective of the planet, considering the amount of species that have been driven extinct and zooming parts per million of carbon and the death of the Great Barrier Reef and all these sorts of things. It's not something that's coming on the horizon, but rather we're living in the midst of it.
The frog in the frying pan, you know, we're not noticing it heat up.
Right. Though I would say, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I feel like in the last 6 to 12 months, perhaps there's been a popular shift in consciousness. I don't know. I know that the Yale Communications Network just did a study, and I think the American populace is at an all-time high, around 62% of understanding that climate change is happening now and that it is man-made. So that's some cause for hope or optimism, but at least it's a nice step forward in terms of social cognition of what's actually happening.
Yeah, exactly. Prying those old fingers off the the issue.
Yeah.
And
I did just want to say quickly, too, in terms of the environmental issues, well, that's one reason obviously we're motivated to work on the population issue. Paul Hawkins' organization, Drawdown, I think it's about 2 years gone by now, but they did a lot of research to figure out, what are the most powerful interventions that humanity could adopt to mitigate emissions. And, they found that, adopting wind turbines on shore, getting a handle on refrigerant management, so ozone materials, reducing food waste and plant-rich diet, adopting plant-rich diets, these were all really important. Now, those were the top four that I just named. But the sixth most powerful intervention to mitigate emissions is educating girls. The seventh is family planning. Mm. And actually, if you add them up, educating girls and family planning, it eclipses wind turbines and vegetarian diets by quite a bit. So that just kind of goes to show you. And the reason that those two things, educating girls and family planning, are so important, one of the primary reasons is they will lead to a slowing and eventual stop of population growth.
Exactly. It's a straightforward equation, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, it really is. It's not. It's not. Doesn't need Einstein to figure that one out.
Right.
And
so you would think it might have after 40 years of fiddling around while
we're on bird. Well, that's it, because there's so many vested interests in wanting to move it the other way. That's the trouble, yep. Isn't it? It's the gravy train. Talking about, obviously, educating girls and family planning, I know you've got a new white paper out, specifically, really about a lot of that. Can you tell us about that? What you're trying to, bring out?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. At least in the international development circles, it's well known that there are around 225 million in the developing world who have what is called an unmet need for contraception. So this is women who don't want to be pregnant in the next 2 years, but aren't using modern contraception, so this is defined as unmet need. And they get a lot of attention, as they should. That's a constituency that would benefit from modern contraception. Usually, this is framed as because these 225 million women aren't able to access contraception. Mm. But Population Media Center, over the years, we've studied the demographic and health survey reports, and we found that women rarely cite a lack of access or rarely cite cost or convenience as the reason they're not using contraception. Rather, the major impediments to uptake are rooted in apprehension, fear-inducing rumors, myths about the safety and efficacy of modern contraception. So, for example, there was recently a study, I guess it's 3 or 4 years gone by, a study of 5 major Kenyan cities. 80% of the adult population of those cities thought that using modern contraception would give them cancer. So there's these very powerful rumors around modern contraception in many parts of the world. And then, as we discussed, there's religiosity, patriarchy, often fatalism, too. So the belief that God determined at the beginning of the universe how many children I would have, so whether I use contraception or not doesn't make any difference. Those sort of thoughts. So basically, part of the white paper is to reinforce the notion that contraceptive supply chains are absolutely critical. Of course, you have to have the supply chains. You got to have the commodities on the shelf. But oftentimes, at this point, the commodities actually are on the shelf, but they're still not being used because of these sociocultural impediments to their use. So that's part of the white paper. And this white paper is available at populationmedia.org. And then, of course, there's another huge constituency of non-users of contraception. For example, in the developing world alone, there's 1.6 billion women of reproductive age, but only about half of them want to avoid a pregnancy at all. And that's where it gets back into the ideal number of children. In Gambia in 2013, the ideal number of children was 6.5, and 73% of Gambian women never intended to use contraception again. And then if you continue to study this, you see that other organizations are coming to the same conclusion, including the Regal Guttmacher Institute, who stated a couple years ago that family planning programs have existed for some time in most of the developing world. Sources of supplies have expanded. Methods are offered at low cost or free of charge. And even though these access-related problems have been resolved, women have these other reasons for non-use at this point, which are those socially cultural driven impediments to uptake. So that's the bad news, but the good news is that decades of work in the social and behavior change sciences show that interventions like population media centers, which is theory-driven entertainment, can spark emotive psychological desires to reject those oppressive social norms, to find a way around the myths and rumors, and also provide agency and confidence to pioneer new social norms. So that's why we do our work. And, of course, we use mass media because of cost efficiency, right? The more people you can reach with these messages and stories, the more cost effective. More cost-effectively, you can do that. So that's a summary of the white paper, and I would encourage everyone to go ahead and download that at our website.
It's really getting that last mile, isn't it? You know, yeah. You get the big picture close, but then it's just that last connectivity bit is the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
And but as you say, but it's beautiful how you tie that back in with your work, you know, with films and radio, where you give people examples and something to start from. I mean, that's the key,
isn't it? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what I've always appreciated about our work is it's really, well, you mentioned it in the beginning. I mean, it's not sort of a lecture or a scolding, or it's an entertainment product that basically offers people a different perspective that they may never have had the opportunity to come across in any other way other than this entertaining program they're listening to on radio or watching on TV. And all it really does is hold up a possibility, and then it's up to the individual to decide if that possibility works for them or not, and if they're really left to their own agency and autonomy to choose. And, you know, if they realize that, oh, I could use modern contraception and that would be absolutely fine and that's my own decision, I'm going to go to the clinic tomorrow, then, you know, that's good for them. But if that's not the way it strikes them, I mean, there's no, you know, that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, there's got to be that one final decision. Yeah.
Yep.
You have to set it up so they know that there's a decision to be made.
Correct, yeah. And, you know, that's the same for everyone in the world about all the decisions we make in our lives. We've got to understand our options and feel like we have the agency to pursue a set of options that make sense to us.
And your group has really pulled a lot together to really get that beautiful overview and make an impact.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we certainly are vested into this interest. We were founded on the concern for the environment and the understanding of the population factor in there, but also the understanding that there's a correct way to address the population issue and an incorrect way. You know, unfortunately, we spoke of the baggage of the population issue at the outset of the show. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of people who perhaps with some well intentions just advocate around this issue in a very damaging functional way. So calls for, you know, strict one-child policies or, you know, this or that that really aren't necessary and are, you know, immoral, aren't helpful to the debate, because what we really need is these investments in programs like population media centers, these investments in family planning and women's empowerment around the world. And those are win-win scenarios, you know. No one's losing out when a girl is better educated. No one's losing out when women have equal social status to men. No one's losing out when someone can access and have the agency to use modern contraception. These are win-win scenarios. So that's one area I actually am hopeful in, is I think the younger generation of folks who I am interacting with in the course of my day and work day, they perceive and understand the importance of humanity's scale and the population issue, yet they have this real progressive sense of what needs to happen and what the appropriate help we can offer people around the world is. So that's very encouraging.
How do they actually access the work? Is it just put on regular TV channels and radio stations? How is that done?
Well, it really depends on what our formative research determines is the most viable content delivery strategy. So oftentimes, in radio, we'll do 156-episode radio drama that extends over the course of 2 years, so we'll release 2 programs a week, the 15 minutes a piece, because that's what most people listen to their entertainment on, is the radio.
Okay.
We've also, in the United States, we did our half-hour television program on Hulu, because that was a story about people living in Southern California, and lo and behold, a lot of people in Southern California watch Hulu TV, so that's where we put our content on. So it's really on a situational, specific decision of where we'll put the content. Traditionally, it's been radio and TV, but of course, as you suggested, with all these new forms of media, social media, YouTube, and that sort of thing, we have a lot more options these days to work with, depending on how those beneficiary audiences are actually consuming their media.
Great work. Well, thank you, Joe. Joe Bish of the Population Media Center.
Yeah, that sounds great. I appreciate the time and the opportunity, and of course, always feel free to stay in touch. Yeah, I hope everyone takes a moment to give us a Google and come on over and see what we're doing.
Is there any upcoming events or things that people should be aware of in the field?
Well, every July 11th is World Population Day, so that's sort of a day that the UN has set aside to recognize the importance of the population issue and what it means for development. So that'll be coming up. So I'd encourage people to Google that day or come to our site. We've got a place where you can sign up and to stay involved and keep informed around that. We also have subscription products. I curate a weekly news digest. I keep track of the global news flow on a weekly basis and usually pick out 20 to 25 stories that I put in a newsletter that would keep you very well informed about all these sorts of issues happening all around the world. So there's a lot of ways that you can go get engaged at populationmedia.org.
A pleasure to speak with you, Joe, and good work, and look forward to chatting again.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you, Joe. Okay.
Yep.